great embarrassment to have to open this meeting, although I have worked in electron microscopy for quite a while. When I started, I wasn't an electron microscopist, and when I met Nigel in 1973, I was determined never to learn any electron microscopy. And the idea was that Nigel would do it all, and I would just talk to him.
This technology is just too much.
Too much, yeah. Anyway, I'll just, for the record, I'll just... So the original idea was that I wouldn't learn any electron microscopy and Nigel would do it all and I would just talk to him. That's just for the record, whoever's recording it. However, as it turned out, the power of the method, we had a discussion about what the power of the method means. It usually means you've failed, it turns out, if you have to talk about it. But anyway, the idea was that it was very productive and did give you the answer. And so actually, after a year or two, I decided it would be a good idea to learn electron microscopy. And that was about 30 years ago. But giving this opening talk now, Future of Cryo-EM, is a little bit embarrassing since I've been sort of out of doing it personally for a while, and so I am a bit rusty, and I'm looking forward to this meeting to re-oil the wheels. Okay, so Future of Cryo-EM, we all have our different opinions about it, and in the past I've been very optimistic and felt that the method was potentially so powerful that you'd simply be able to take pictures and get the structure of everything and put out of business all the other structural biologists, all the X-ray crystallographers, all the NMR people. And we did have this idea of global domination at one point, but that seems to have receded. So today I thought I'd just mention two rival views. One is, of course, you get to see it in advance, but one is the optimistic view of the future, which is that, the microscopes often don't work. They're often very expensive. They still don't have chromatic aberration correctors. They contaminate, they drift, and so on. But hopefully, all these instrumental problems will be solved, and you'll just put your specimen in, and it'll be perfect, just like driving a modern car. Specimen preparation, which, again, people use all sorts of different tricks to get round difficulties that they foresee, and it would be very nice if that could become straightforward. The main problems, which I think is the topic of one of the panels, that the specimens get charged up. We don't know exactly how much they get charged up, 5 volts, 10 volts, 20 volts. The successive parts of the image see a different specimen from what the early parts see, and so that the images that you get are an average of the specimen as it's changing as a result of the charging and beam damage. And then that charging and those bond breaking causes movement in the specimen. And these are things that we know exist, but we don't really have very good diagnoses of what the magnitude of those effects are so that you can minimize them and overcome that. But if you could, then it would work much, much better. In the different methodologies, people have gradually been pushing the resolution higher and higher. And if you ask people, what is it they're doing now that they didn't do 5 years ago, it's never very clear. The resolution keeps improving. People keep doing better. And in principle, you ought to be able to get resolutions at 3 angstroms all the time. So, that would be very good. And then the final thing is that once people collect their data and they get their structure, and they publish a paper, they don't really know whether it's correct or not. In some aspects of microscopy, the crystallography 2D crystals, for example, there is signal-to-noise ratio. You can get a spot in a background. You can have error bars. You can merge them together with signal-to-noise weighting and so on. So there are aspects of the of electron cryo microscopy where there are indices, but areas like single particle EM, where you calculate two structures and you compare them, and there's a certain RMS difference and so on, but you don't really know whether the two structures you're comparing are systematically wrong in the same way, and therefore your error is making you more optimistic. So what we do lack reliable indices for telling whether when you read a paper or if you referee a paper, is this right or wrong? And in a way, this is we're hoping that in getting a reliable index like that, you're asking someone from outside to come in and, as in the X-ray crystallography with free R factor and normal R factors, you're asking for some way to prove that's testable and reliable, and that we don't have that at the moment. And in a way, that's like having a day of reckoning. So you do your best work, you publish it, and then you have a really good way of finding out whether it's right or wrong. So if we could get all of these problems, instrumental problems, specimen preparation, good indices, good ways of getting it, then you really would have a method that everyone would be delighted with and you could use to solve the structures of all the things that you're interested in. And I think there's no reason why that shouldn't work. So that's the optimistic view. On the other hand, it might be that it's very difficult to get ultra-high vacuums, that as chromatic and spherical aberration correctors are brought in, each one that you have to buy costs another $5 million. And, individual labs will not be able to afford it, so that the route that you'll go, instead of having a universal method that everyone can use in every university in the country or in the world, instead you'll have to have regional centers, and by the time you've got your instrument working, the next regional center has got a better one that comes along. So you never... And everyone only wants to use one machine because it was the one that came on stream, and then all the other ones have to play catch up, and that's an unattractive scenario, and that's sort of what happens at synchrotrons at the moment. So people take their crystal to a synchrotron, and they don't get very good data. So they go to another synchrotron, they go to another one, they say, "Oh, that one's very good," and then everyone flocks to that synchrotron. That would be what you really want, is to have an instrument that you buy, and then when you've got it, it works just as well as the one in Yoshi's lab, for example. So anyway, we don't know. That's for the future. I mentioned beam-induced charging and movement before. We don't really have a handle on that at the moment. For example, it would be very nice to know, when you take pictures of single particles in ice, and you put the beam on it, and then you take another picture and another picture, and the particles, they do move sideways, they do rotate. No one has measured how much they move and how much they rotate as a function of dose and as a function of the size of the particles. So it could well be, this is a possibility, and this is a hypothesis for Bridget to test during the next year, could well be that as the size of your single particles gets smaller and you put the same beam on it, the same number of electrons per square angstrom, that the amount of movement of that particle is greater and the amount of rotation of it is greater. And if that was true, that would mean that you could only ever work with really big things because they would only hold still long enough for you to get the data that you need to get the higher resolution. So there are lots of experiments that need to be done that haven't been done, and depending on how they turn out, you'll either have your optimistic or your pessimistic scenario. So then in this pessimistic scenario where everything is expensive and you have to go to, travel halfway across the country, and when you get there your specimen keeps moving, it will be difficult to get all the structures that you want at high resolutions and with the accuracy that you want. and then you'll, you know, you'll be trying very hard and you won't get very far. And then the final one is, and I think we're already in this situation actually, that people do their work, they do their very best, they think of everything to test, and they think it must be true, but they don't prove it, and then they publish a paper. And then a year or two later, turns out to be wrong. And in our field, so far, this cryo-electromicroscopy, we have not had too many of these high-profile scandals. But in other fields, like X-ray crystallography and in NMR spectroscopy, there have been such things in the past. And, for example, in 1982, there was a structure done by X-ray that was wrong, and the NMR one was right. And that then raised up and gave the NMR field a much better reputation than it genuinely deserved, actually. So, you know, we want to avoid having that here because, you know, one bad thing like that ruins the reputation of the field, and that will affect, you know, your salary, your grant application, your ability to recruit students. They'll say, oh, we don't want to come and do that EM. We've got to go to the synchrotron and do X-ray. So, you know, there are real risks here. So anyway, it's the goal of the field and the goal of the people at meetings like this to try and be clever about addressing the problems such that the outcome is in the optimistic half rather than in the pessimistic half. And so being realistic, it's very rare in life for everything to turn out perfectly, but it's also very rare for it all to go wrong. So obviously it'll be somewhere in between, and we don't know that yet. We really don't know how we're going to overcome the charging and movement. We don't know how much we're going to be paying for our microscopes in about 5 or 10 years. It might be quite a lot, actually, if it turns out chromatic aberration correctors work and are useful. And, you know, anyway, but we can probably be more conservative and be more critical in refereeing papers and so on to try and avoid this and be more successful. Anyway, that was my effort at being either positive or negative, but somewhere in between, for Ron's or Bridget's topic for the talk. So for the rest of it, I thought I would like to grind a few of my favorite axes and to explain how it is that I like to think about electron cryomicroscopy. And some of you, the old-timers, if you like, will have seen and heard these talks and arguments before, but hopefully there are enough new people that, you know, there'll be an element of novelty in it. And then I thought of what I'd do is to talk a little bit about each of the different areas of focus of electron cryomicroscopy: 2D crystals, helices, single particles, and tomography, from the point of view of that overall analysis, and then end up with one new slide. So, sorry. This is called value for money. All right, so you'll see lots of pictures like this, I'm sure, so the idea in the microscope is you have your specimen, you have your beam, the electrons are scattered, some of them are scattered after inelastic events and do damage in the specimen. And those inelastically scattered electrons lose some of their coherence, both in the direction. They're very parallel at the beginning, and they're very monochromatic. But if they do an inelastic event, then they change direction slightly, and they change energy slightly. And so, whereas you had a beautiful monochromatic parallel beam to start with, after an inelastic event, that particular electron has lost some of its purity, and the image you get is not as good. And the thing to remember, I think, which I found particularly useful, is that in a normal electron microscope, the way we use it for electron cryomicroscopy, we've drawn all these beams and all these scattering and so on, but actually, in the column at one time, there is only one electron. So, you know, you've got your specimen, and the beam is fairly dim, and the electron is coming down, and that electron has the energy and, you know, is defined in space. And if that electron loses energy, that's a real event, energy is deposited in the specimen, the electron carries on going slightly slower in a slightly different direction, but it continues through the specimen, and before or after that inelastic event, it is still doing diffraction and elastics and behaving as a wave and gaining phase contrast and so on. And so the electrons in the image have an integration of all of the events that that electron has experienced as it goes through the specimen. And a lot of the ways of thinking about things in which you separate the electrons out into the energy loss and the non-energy loss and you have an energy filter and so on involve quite complicated ways of thinking about what the different electrons do. But if you don't have an energy filter, the image that you get is a composite of the results of all those interactions. Anyway, the most important electrons at high resolution are the ones that are elastically scattered and don't deposit energy, and they are collected by the lens, focused back to form a diffraction pattern, then an image. And generally at the moment, although in the future we're going to be hearing about quarter wave plates by some of the other people, we have an under-focused bright field phase contrast image, which is normally what we're doing. And normally people are using doses, if it's at room temperature, less than 1 electron per square angstrom. If it's cryo, 5 or 10 electrons per square angstrom. If it's low resolution, like tomography, you might go up to 30, 40, 50 electrons per square angstrom. If you're at liquid helium rather than nitrogen, again, you can go a bit higher. But in this range, and all of the exposures that are done to organic or biological specimens in that range are doing a lot of damage to the specimen. So parts of the protein molecules are falling off, carboxyl groups, cysteines and disulfides are being oxidized, and probably actually we know from some of the X-ray diffraction experiments in which there is similar damage, but from X-rays rather than electrons, but the X-rays create electrons that do damage, it's exactly the same damage. We know that even at 100 times lower dose than that, you're still damaging your molecule. So whatever you get a picture of is going to be damaged. Okay, so that's just, you know, just to start with. Okay, so now this is a picture from a paper that Peter Rosenthal and I wrote about 4 years ago. And putting aside the physics of the electron scattering and the electron energy loss and so on, this was the overview that we came up with that we thought was quite a useful way of thinking about what's happening in your imaging and what you get in a real image as opposed to a theoretical image and what you can do about it in terms of averaging. And the general idea is we're plotting the average value of the structure factor, the amplitude of the diffraction from your specimen as a function of the resolution squared. And the idea is that this thick red line is what you'd expect in theory. In other words, at very low resolution, so at sort of several hundred angstroms, if you've got a particle that's 100 or 200 angstroms in diameter, at very low resolution, all the atoms in that particle are effectively localized at one point. And so the structure factor is equal to the number of atoms in the particle. So that's n atoms. And we've got a 0.28 there because normally in electron cryomicroscopy we have our protein molecules or RNA or whatever in an ice background, and proteins have a density of about 1.4 grams per cc, ice about 1. So there is a contrast reduction instead of protein versus a vacuum of about a factor of 3 or 4. And so actually the low resolution structure factor is, roughly speaking, 0.3 times the number of atoms. And then as you go out in reciprocal space, the particle has a certain radius, and to a first approximation has a radius of gyration, and the original diffraction theory of single molecules in solution was the Guinier plot, for this French guy Guinier. And what happens is you plot the amplitude against the resolution squared, and the slope of that first part of the fade out of the diffraction is as you go up to in size, or you go down in spatial frequency, the slope of that line gives you the radius of gyration. Or 1 over the radius of gyration. And also, a smaller structure has a smaller number of atoms, and the larger structure has a larger number. So you have these falling at that very low resolution part. If you now go to the high resolution part, at resolutions beyond about 8 or 10 angstrom resolution, you can think of all the atoms as being, they're not randomly placed, of course, because they're bonded and so on, but from the point of view of diffraction theory, they're randomly placed. And then the Wilson theory of diffractions, which is used a lot in crystallography but applies equally well to particles in ice, the average structure factor at high resolution is the square root of the number of atoms because you're adding them randomly, they're uncorrelated. So the overall shape of this curve starts at, roughly speaking, 0.3 times the number of atoms and ends up as that black line would be the square root of the number of atoms. But, of course, each atom has a certain size, and as you get out to 3 angstrom or 4 angstrom resolution, there is a fade-out, and that's the form factor in X-ray crystallography and in electron diffraction. So you have a curve of that shape, and then there's an intermediate region between about 10 angstroms and, shall we say, the diameter of the particle, where, depending on the nature of your object, if it's a hollow sphere with holes in it or if it's a tightly packed protein that's very tight, there will be structure in this intermediate region. So this will be somewhat structured, and we haven't shown that. We've just drawn it as a smooth curve. Okay, so that's what happens in theory. Then you take a picture of it in the electron microscope with radiation damage and movement and charging, and that image that you record on film or a detector is somewhat blurred compared to what it really would be in theory. And so blurring you can represent, depending on the nature of the blurring, as some kind of fade-out. But if it's Gaussian blurring, it'll be a Gaussian fade-out, and so you then get effectively a temperature factor in the decrease of the structure factors. And so here, that top dotted line, the red one, is meant to be the fade-out as a result of the fact that the image is not a perfect representation of the structure like you'd want it to be in our most optimistic scenario. So it's worse than that, and these diffraction intensities, the spots in a crystal, the continuous transform in the 2D, the layer lines in a helix, fade out as you go out to higher resolution. And then if you're doing image processing and you have to figure out where the lattice is, where the molecules are, what their orientations are, your computational parameter determination will also be wrong, and that will have errors in it, at least not wrong, but some errors, and that will then cause a further fade out. When you're averaging these things together, you're averaging things that shouldn't be, and they fade out more rapidly. So that's the curves. And then the other thing that's on this graph is the idea that when you take your picture, limited by radiation damage to 5 electrons per square angstrom, or more or less, depending on the condition, you get a certain amount of noise in the image. And for the kind of proteins that we're talking about, we've drawn in here, roughly speaking, that top dotted line is the amount of noise that you'd get if you had just one part. It's meant to represent what you'd get the noise from one particle. Perhaps if you took a tilt series and did a tomographic reconstruction, you'd have a very noisy 3D map. The noise in the structure factors of that image, 2D or 3D, and so would have a certain level. And if you just had one particle, that would mean that the structure factors that are from the diffraction from the particle from the microscope would all, for most resolutions, would be much less than that noise level. Only at very low resolution might you see it, and only perhaps when it's a larger object. This is the predicted distribution of power in the structure factors. This is what you'd get with the noise in that level of exposure. So then if you want higher resolution, which we all do want for the molecules mostly, we'll come to tomography in a moment, what you have to do then is to average. And it doesn't matter really if you average in real space or average in a crystal and get spots or average on a helix and so on. But when you do that and you calculate maps by all sorts of methods, you still get the same radial distribution, you get the same blurring, you get the same parameter problems, but the noise drops as you have 10 and then 100 and 1,000. And then I'll show it later on, but this is not the place to go into it. But anyway, I tried about 10 years ago or so to do a calculation from first principles to figure out how many particles you needed, and we ended up with about 10,000. But that was a very conservative estimate. And Bob Glaser did another calculation, being more realistic, and got it down to a few thousand. And then I'll show you at the end, Peter Rosenthal, after with some real data, and then more rigorous estimates of noise level, recalculated again. And it's the same theory. The theory hasn't been changed, but the criterion has been changed, and it comes out at 1,000 or 5, not very many. So if you average a certain number of particles that have been properly imaged and don't have any of these experimental losses, strictly speaking, the noise should be less than the expected signal when you're at the level of 1,000 or so particle images. If you've got really crap images, of course, you might need 1,000,000. But if you've got really good ones, you should manage with only 500 or 1,000. Okay. But then, of course, you've got your real blurring in the images, and you've got your real... So in reality, you need a lot more than that, 10,000, 100,000, so on. And then in this radial distribution function of the structure factors, eventually, if you haven't got enough images and you're looking at real data and you're really averaging it, there will be then... You will reach that level that is the noise. So the expected shape of the curve is that it's very strong at low resolution, then it fades, and then at some point it should become constant. And that constant doesn't mean that you've got a really nice structure factor. That just means that you've reached the area where the noise takes over. And that vertical dotted line then is meant to be where you ought to say, that is my resolution. So let's say it's 8 or 9 angstrom resolution, you can see helices. 4 angstroms, you can see beta sheets. 3 angstroms, you can see side chains and things like that. So, and that would be... So I felt this was a very useful way of looking at what's happening in the image. It takes into consideration radiation damage. It's the noise level. It's particle averaging. And in a way, it applies to any way that you do the averaging. Okay, so I thought I should just show one example to sort of put people's feet on the ground. This is the one that Peter Rosenthal worked on. This is a icosahedral pyruvate dehydrogenase catalytic core with holes in it. It's icosahedral, twofold, threefold, and fivefold views. If you do your best to align the images, you get a structure at about 8 or 9 angstroms resolution. The one thing that we did, trying to create... what we thought was a rigorous test for whether it was correct or not, was to take 2 pictures instead of taking 1 picture with a certain angular difference between the two. And the idea was that angular difference, which in this case was a 10-degree difference between the first image and the second image of the same field, you would then do your particle alignment, and then you would compare... the angles that you got for the particles in the first image and from the second image, and there would be no assumptions put in. But because you knew when you turned the goniometer that it had turned by 10 degrees, if you didn't get 10 degrees, you knew your software wasn't working properly. And it didn't, actually. The software did not work properly when we did it the first time. We had to do all sorts of tweaks. But then it did. And it's actually 1 or 2 million molecular weight particles. It's quite a big particle. So if it was marginal in this case, once you're down to 1 million, half a million, three quarters, sorry, 1 million, half a million, three quarters of a million, one quarter, then you've got less signal, less noise, more noise, and so on. Anyway, what that is it's the phase residual on the fitting of the particles when you scan the tilt angle difference between the first image and the second image on about 50 particles. And once it was done right, this would be an untilted view. The minimum that you get there is actually at 10 degrees from, and in the right direction. And actually, you could even do it turned out, in the end, with the individual particles. And then this is all, you know, Rosenthal, 2003. These are 50 particles, and the tilt angles and tilt axes of each particle is independently determined, and then you compare the angle and axis of the two particles and plot out the difference between them as though it was a tilt angle. And if they were all exactly right, you'd have 50 little dots, all at 10 degrees. This is 10, 20, 30, and all in the same direction. And instead, what you get, and these were particles picked by eye to be good particles, you get a cluster with an angular uncertainty on each particle of about 2 degrees or 2.5 degrees or so. And quite a few particles, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, that are complete rubbish. Now, of course, it was two images. The first image is the real one that you'd normally use, and the second one, you'd say, well, it was radiation damaged. And maybe all six of these are only bad on the second image. But you don't know that. That is an act of wishful thinking, if you like. What's proved only is that some of them are okay, and they're not all that accurate, actually. And so it could well be that that angular uncertainty is a major contribution to the fact that we haven't got 3 angstrom resolution in that. Okay, so if you drop the contouring of this map, you can see that it is 8 or 9 angstrom. You can see the helices. This is the cross-correlation function between the two halves of the data that most of us in the single particle area, but you can also do it, you know, tomographic averaging and so on. And what it showed was that you got 50% cross-correlation at about 11 angstroms. And what Peter and I worried about was that here we are in electron microscopy. We've got our own criteria. We pay no attention whatsoever to what other people have been doing for decades in other fields. So what we thought would be good would be to try to relate this kind of cross-correlation to what the X-ray crystallographers do. And they have a figure of merit, which is the cosine of the mean of the phase error in the phase angle for the Fourier components. And generally speaking, they think of 0.5 as being very good. And 0.5, the mean of the cosine, is a 60-degree phase error. So we try to relate what the X-ray crystallographers think is really great to what people in EM think is really quite reliable. And there have been all sorts of discussions. Anyway, I should go. So I'm not going to... This is in the notes, but this is the actual little bit of mathematics, which I have to say, when we did it first, it wasn't right. But Tony Crowther, fortunately, corrected this. But the idea is that instead of comparing two sets of data, that each of which is half of your data, and because it's half of the data, it's got root 2 times the error of all of your data, and you're comparing two sets, each of which has an error in, so it's root 2 times root 2. So in other words, the comparison that we do here, with half the data being compared, both of them have errors, gives you a pessimistic estimate of how well you're doing, whereas the crystallographers, who have followed their error bars through and calculated it, and they have a figure of merit and so on, they have to be careful that they've got their error estimates right, the e-values and so on. But anyway, the idea is that let me go back onto this slide here, that the Fourier shell correlation, which is on this graph here, is related to a different cross-correlation, which is the cross-correlation between all of your data averaged together and a perfect structure, which you haven't got, but which you imagine, by this formula. So, in other words, C-test is the Fourier shell correlation, and the cross-correlation between your all of your data and your perfect reference is 2 times the Fourier shell correlation over 1 plus the Fourier shell correlation to the power of a half. And when you work that out, if the criteria that we've been using, which is this cross-correlation of a half, corresponds to a figure of merit of 0.8, which the crystallographers would be having champagne parties if they had that, whereas their absolutely wonderful criteria comes out at 0.14. So we therefore said we ought to be, if we've done it right and we haven't biased it, 0.14 should be just fine. So that when you go back to this is the 0.14, so it's the same data, and the map is there. So one way you say my resolution is 11 angstroms, the other way you say my resolution is 8 angstroms. So, you know, you can choose which one you want. And we choose the 8, actually. So, however, you have to be a bit careful because when you're adding together all these images and you're refining it and you may well be overfitting the parameters, you may well be artificially creating agreement between the noise in your data. The noise in one half of your data is being correlated with the noise in the other half of your data, and that raises this up here. And there isn't a really good test at the moment. We need one, and it needs to be properly spelled out, and everybody has to do it. But at the moment, if you're worried that you've done it wrong and you've overfitted it, it might be safer to stick with this one, because this might just be all overfitted noise. And so there are things that we ought to be doing. For example, we ought to be carrying through with our 50,000 or 10,000 or 1,000 particle images. We should be carrying through with them 50 or 10,000 or 1,000 noise images that are exactly the same with the particles. And that's what we do in the 2D crystals, and that's what the X-ray people do. They always have a peak and a background. Okay, that's a bit more. Okay, so at the end of the day, and this is the last one on this kind of overview thing. So in that particular case of that actual structure, the experimental data looks like that thick red line. In other words, you put all the data in, you divide it into 2 halves, you do the cross-correlation and so on, and then you look at the structure factor as a function of resolution. And that is the raw experimental data, which is that red line. And if you remember back to the kind of hand-waving, what do we expect to see, you see that, you know, it starts at 0.28 times the number of atoms. It fades with the radius of gyration of the particle. There's some structure in here. It then settles down onto this line. And then at some point, it starts to go horizontal. And that's where the noise is, because there aren't enough particles for that rate of fall off. If you then take this formula, this cross-correlation between the real data and the theoretical one, that is also the weighting factor that you should apply to your data to get rid of the noise and to give you the proper signal-to-noise weighting. So if you take that middle line, C ref, 2 times the Fourier shell correlation over 1 plus that, and multiply that red line by that middle line, you get the thin red line, and that goes down really nicely on a straight line. And that one, actually, it turns out, is a B factor. You know, the X-ray people are B factors of about 50 or 60. Is not good. 20 is wonderful. This is about 1,000. And that's why you don't get to 3 angstrom resolution. You've got a 1,000 B factor. Some of the better structures that go to 6 angstroms or 4 angstroms and so on, they're lower. They're 500, 600, perhaps 400. Some of the 2D crystals will... I hope I'm not going to... You did say value for money now, but I'm not sure it's value. But anyway, it's time. So this then, the experimental data and the corrected with the weighting factor does fit with the overview quite well. And then what Peter also did was to make an atomic model and put solvent in the best way he could do using the X-ray crystallographic programs, using not this structure, which doesn't have an atomic model, but there was a related one in a different symmetry, a 4-3-2 crystal structure. He put it into the 5-3-2 structure. And that blue line is what you get when you do the same calculation from a perfect model of the structure. If you then take that, the red line corrected for the fade-out, and sharpen it simply by this B factor, which is the 1,000, you get the dotted red line. And so what we're saying is that the agreement between an atomic model with a proper solvent in it, which is the blue one, and the dotted red line, which is corrected both for the fade-out of the amplitudes for all sorts of reasons, and the signal-to-noise ratio, that agreement suggests that we know what we're talking about. We haven't solved any of the problems. We've only got to 8 or 9 angstroms, but we kind of understand what we're doing. And I thought this... Anyway, so Peter went on to use that same X-ray model, which wasn't very good in terms of its solvent, and did a cross-correlation between the X-ray model and the EM 3D data with all of the data in, and that comparison with the X-ray agrees much more closely, particularly at the 50 and the 15% with the X-ray model than the Fourier shell correlation. So this, for us, was a kind of proof that the theory is right, provided you haven't got amplified noise and overfitted things and so on. And then one last thing. This is a table from this review that I mentioned in 1995, where we take different sizes of objects and we follow through purely theoretical, looking at the scattering cross sections, the damages and so on, what the structure factors are in different resolution zones, and we go all the way through to the end and ask how many particles do you need to get a certain signal to noise. And actually we said we wanted 3 sigma. And when you do that, you get this 10 or 12,000 particles, independent of the size of the particle. So if you've got a smaller particle, you've got less signal, you need more of them, but you need less rotated views. Bigger particles, the structure factors are stronger. You need fewer of them to get the projections, but you need more projections. And that they exactly match if you look at the equations. So roughly speaking, you need the same number of particles. And it doesn't matter whether it's 2D crystals, helices, single particles. And the more conservative numbers here are probably 500 or 600, if the data are good. And then the other thing that's in this calculation is that given the images have a certain signal to noise, you cannot... There are two things you cannot do at different sizes of proteins. If the protein is too small... For example, supposing you had a protein consisting of 2 amino acids and you took electron cryomicroscopy pictures of it, you wouldn't be able to tell that you hadn't just taken a picture of water, because they would be too small, they would move around, they'd be radiation damaged, and after 5 electrons per square angstrom, it turns out you need to be about 10 kilodaltons, that's these lines here. You need a 10 kilodalton protein to find out where it is, and you need about a 50 kilodalton protein to find out its orientation, in theory. But in practice, the images are blurry, they're charged, so it's much higher than that, several hundred thousand. But it is an attempt to do the calculation, and it does mean that if you believe it, you're an optimist. But if you're a scientist, what you're trying to do is to eliminate all the problems that limit us to 8 or 9 angstroms, solve them so that you can get into that stage. And then the last thing that Peter did was to do this global plot, which is meant to be, this is the equivalent of the meaning of life for electron cryomicroscopists. What it shows is how many particles you need to get to a particular resolution, depending on what the B factor of your say intrinsic disorder plus bad images plus bad computer programs gives you a B factor. And if you get a B factor of 125, so some of the best images of two-dimensional crystals can have B factors of 100 or less, then it turns out you can get out to beyond 4 angstroms resolution. And this is expressed as icosahedral asymmetric units with about 5 or 6 thousand particles. And most of the people doing 2D crystals have had 1 million or 4 million unit cells that they were averaging. So they were not having B factors. They were more like 250 or 300 and so on. And the single particles that we've been hearing about, our one was 1,000, and the black and the open symbol were the resolution that was obtained, 8.7 angstroms, the number of particles that were used was 3,600, and the theory that was in that previous slide gave you the black dots. So basically, we think the theory meets with the experiment, and there is an overview that if the analysis of a particular specimen that you're interested in is done, you can find out how much more work you have to do. And it turns out that for most of these single particles, to get to 3 angstroms, it is impossible in your lifetime. You need 10 to the 10th or something like that. Okay, so let me go a bit. I was going to say just a few things now about each, just a few remarks now about each of the areas in which it turns out most of us are specialists. So I like 2D and zero dimensional crystals, i.e. single particles and 2D crystals. I always felt that helices were something that, you know, others should do. And and also 3D crystals. If you there are people trying to do three-dimensional electron crystallography with thick crystals, and once they get bigger than a certain thickness, you get multiple scattering, and there are other problems. So depending on what you're trying to do, for example, if you work on microtubules, you just have to do some helical diffraction, although you can treat it as single particles. But anyway, each of the areas have specialist programs of their own, but in essence, they're all doing the same thing. They're all doing averaging. And what I've tried to do is to put down all the plus points, the minus points, and then some pointers to the future. So in 2D crystals, the great thing is, provided you've got a good crystal, it's very easy to average tens of thousands of unit cells. And then you can get out, depending on how hard you work, to a resolution. But you do have to, the crystal has to be well ordered, and the resolution that you get is only as good as the crystal order. So you can't, at the moment, take a crystal that diffracts to 6 angstroms, but you know it's made up of molecules, each of which is ordered to 2 angstroms. You ought to be able to take that rough position of those molecules and get it to 6 angstroms crystallographically and then 2 angstroms as single particles. Can't do that at the moment. The other good thing is that the lattice defines the position and orientation accurately, and as it turns out, for most things, more accurately than all the single particle algorithms do. However, the resolution is only as good as the crystal order, so the spots fade out, that's it, you can't do any better, and that is what all the X-ray crystallographers are stuck with. They grow a crystal, it looks beautiful, they put it in the beam, spots go to 10 angstroms, they throw it away and make another crystal. In principle, one day, we ought not to need to do that in the EM. Also, if you have a crystal, you know, you are making bonds between the unit cells, between the molecules. If you're interested in structural changes, they might be blocked, or when you try to induce the structural change, they may become more disordered. If the images could be made better in terms of this B factor and the blurring and the charging and so on, so that you had more power in them, then each of the unit cells, or even each of the molecules in the asymmetric unit, could be treated as individual single particles, but you would know where they were within an angstrom or two, and you'd know their orientation within a degree or two. So you wouldn't have to search over this vast orientational position. And it ought then to be possible to go beyond the order of the crystal. And I think that's a few of people have tried that, and I'll show one of Nico's slides in a minute. That was an earlier demonstration of diffraction spots in electron diffraction and diffraction spots in a Fourier transform of an image, and a comparison of the two, the ratio of the image amplitude to the electron diffraction amplitude as a function of the resolution. And this was one of the images that Nigel took early on when I was trying to avoid becoming an electron microscopist. A beautiful image, but it was at room temperature, and it had a B of 750. And that's, you know, partly because of radiation damage. It was blasted. And then as we went to liquid helium and liquid nitrogen and so on, the B factor has got better, same specimen, this is Bacteriodopsin, and you get out to, you know, 3.5 angstroms or 2.5 angstroms. And I know Yoshi has some that are up here that are really nice. So that's the best people have been able to do, but the fact that you can get a picture with a B factor of 120 or even 80 with that level of dose, whereas when you go to single particles, you get 500, 600, 700, or 1,000, means it cannot be, that's not a fundamental limitation. It cannot be due to the fact that radiation damage is killing it, and that's because here you have a picture of another biological and organic material, and it's worked. So it ought to work if you get it right in the single particles as well. And then I just picked out this table from a paper that Nico wrote about 10 years ago. And actually earlier we'd done normal purple membrane, but this is this deoxycholate extracted purple membrane with a shrunken unit cell, which actually Bob Glaser again discovered in when he was in Cambridge in about 1983 or so. And there was some early work on it, sort of low-resolution projection. Anyway, Nico took this and with Eric Beckman and Fritz Evelyn got a really nice projection structure at about 2.5 angstroms and tried to process it, well, did process it, both crystallographically and as essentially as single particles, as single unit cells. So when you take one unit cell and cross-correlate it with a picture of a 2D crystal, there's not much scattering matter in one unit cell compared to the bigger areas. So you get a cross-correlation peak, but it's noisy and it's not very accurately positioned. And the way we get around that is you do a bit of averaging locally, and you take the average of essentially of 4 or 14 or 70 unit cells. And if you don't do any averaging, of course, your crystal probably is a bit bent. So the idea was to compare the effect of repositioning the unit cells according to cross-correlation peaks obtained with one unit cell or more. And that these last two columns show how many diffraction spots out to about 3.5 angstroms you get when you do these different approaches. And what you see is that the best result is obtained a signal-to-noise of 41 over 7 and the number of strong spots, 107 here, when you're using the reference area that's about 3 or 4 unit cells square, so 14 unit cells altogether. And what that says is that the crystal itself, the molecules in the crystal, know where they are better than the image knows. So the image only knows that it's roughly in a certain position. You've still done better. You've still got a signal. This is 4 above a background of 7, but it's 10 times better if you use the cross-correlation peak from a local average. And what that says is this image is not good enough. Well, it's just about good enough to use single particles. But had this been a crystal where the diffraction spots faded out at 7 angstroms, and you said, okay, we're going to use the single unit cells, you would have been able to just about get a signal. But basically, the quality of the images, the data, the way we do the specimen, the way we collect it, just wasn't quite good enough. And so this was set aside, but, you know, it could be gone back to. Okay, the second thing I thought I'd just say a little bit about is the thing that I don't like personally, but others have been really good at, Nigel particularly, and Keiichi Namba in Japan with Fujiyoshi's microscope. And the idea is that helical arrays, they're also very well ordered, and you also have a geometrical relationship between the molecules. And I used to think that they were 1D crystals, but I now feel it's better to describe them as a crystal that's with an order between 1 and 2. Because if you've got lots of molecules just end-to-end in a string, that's sort of like a 1D crystal. But if they go around in a very, very large hoop, like I'll show one of Nigel's pictures in a minute, it's essentially a 2D crystal. So helices have a geometrical arrangement between the successive subunits as they go along the helix that is somewhere between a one-dimensional and a two-dimensional crystal. But it's not a flat sheet. And in one picture, you get all the views. So the great thing about it, you get one picture, you get the 3D structure. It may be noisy because you've only got 1,000 particle, has 1,000 molecules in it, but you don't have a missing cone, so that's a plus point. Also, some of the filaments are really well ordered along the axis, they may be a bit floppy sideways, so there are, depending on the structure you want to know and what it does in biology, there may be no alternative to doing that. However, if it's a thin helix like actin, it often bends and twists a lot, and you have to unbend it and so on. You don't know if you're unbending the molecules, which may not should not be, you know, they are protein molecules, they're probably relatively rigid. It's probably the boundary between them that you should be altering, and you don't know where that is. So there is a problem. And then large diameter ones, like the acetylcholine receptor tubes, several hundred angstroms in diameter, you never quite know. Well, it turns out there are ways of finding out, but it might be squashed, and it doesn't really form, doesn't follow the geometry. So there are problems that you have to address and overcome. But again, if you could get really good images, you could treat little bits of that helix and unbend them and treat them almost as little bits of things. And that's the way that Carsten Saxe with NICO, Nigel with acetylcholine receptor, and Keiichi Namba's group with the bacterial flagella, they have used unbending descriptions to basically do single particle averaging of them. And that's just to, you know, remind you what a helix looks like. But it's very nice. This is Nigel's acetylcholine receptor, Nigel's ferritin, Nigel's, and then a cross section with the, and actually he has the atoms in it. I think he'll show them. Okay, so single particles now. So my feeling is that this is really the big prize in biology. I mean, there are other consolation prizes, but this one is the big one because you don't have to make any crystals. So if you don't have to make any crystals, you don't have to make good crystals. You don't really need to purify it because if, let's say it's 90% pure, you've got a few bits and pieces, you can just ignore it. And as Joachim Frank used to say, you purify it in the computer after you've failed. If you're not a very good biochemist, this might be the method for you. And it's the most generally applicable because actually, in principle, you could just take a cell, smash it up, and try and look for the things, the molecules that were the same. The problem about it, which is not analyzed yet, is that in a crystal, you know, you are locking things in. And it could be that the actual crystal creates the order, whereas before the molecules are a bit floppy. So they might. It might be, I think this is a matter of faith that you have to have. And because the edges of the molecule are then hanging into space and they're surrounded by solvent, instead of having a particular interaction with another molecule in the crystal, it could be that the beam-induced image blurring, that the reason we, in other words, the reason that we get lower resolution with single particles than you do with 2D crystals or helices could be that the beam-induced image blurring and charging and so on has a bigger effect because there's nothing holding them, they're just flapping around. And again, that's unanswered. But coming back to the sort of the theoretical thoughts, there's no reason in principle why you ought not to be able to reach any resolution you want using single particle approaches. And the better the images are, you can then subdivide them and remove the ones that have domains pointing in different directions. So, you know, I think this is one that deserves a lot of effort. And then I didn't want to show any, you know, new data, but I did want to remind the people that this idea of freezing single particles in thin films of ice started with Jacques Dubréchet's group at EMBL in about 1982-83. And that's one of his original adenovirus pictures with a bit of it that was on the front cover of Nature in 1984. And that sort of set the field going. And Jacques is such a idiosyncratic but modest person that I think we need to keep remembering that he's, you know, did that. Okay, so tomography was the last area which again has a very general potential power in that if you are doing tomography of cryosections or spread out molecules or just a thin film of particles, the alignment that you do, because you take a tilt series, you're aligning the whole image of the whole field, and you're not aligning the single particle. So you're probably aligning tens or hundreds of hundreds of millions of Daltons of mass. And so if it works, then you don't have to worry about the alignment and the unbending and so on. You can align the whole field at once. You can add things, because you can see them and you can ignore them afterwards, like colloidal gold, to improve the alignment. And again, you can look at anything, a piece of a cell or some spread. So it is a very general method. And I think once you've bought the electron microscope and it's a high voltage one, you can easily do tomography as well as the other things as well. So I think there's been a recent resurgence, or not a resurgence, but a recent feeling that the methods are beginning to work quite well. Okay, but the downsides are you have to take a large number of tilt views, and during that irradiation of the specimen, the charging and tilting it, of course, the structure may change. And, for example, there's quite an interesting paper from Grant Jensen's group showing how these thin films change when you irradiate them. And of course, that will affect the 3D reconstruction you try to make by that tilt series in the tomography. And then if you go back to the first picture I showed with the noise that you get from one image, if you've got no averaging, you can never get, the crossover was about 20 angstroms, you can never get for single particle without doing any averaging ever better than 15 or 20 angstrom resolution. And in reality at the moment, it's more like 40 or 50 angstroms. But with improvements in instrumentation, you should be able to do a bit better, but you can never do 3 angstroms. You have to do the averaging for that, and that averaging is 1,000 or several thousand. So in tomography, unlike in single particles where you can average, you must make use of every electron to get the maximum, and at the moment we just don't do that. The detectors are not very good. Many of the electrons are lost. So the way to get from 40 or 50 to 15 or 20 probably involves mainly detector improvements. And the other thing that's worth mentioning is that although everyone has programs for processing 2D crystals, single particles, and so on, different program packages, in principle, any of these other specimens could be done by tomography. You could take a tomographic tilt series, tomographic reconstruction, and then do all the averaging later in real space. So subsequent real space averaging of the tomographic 3D density. And what isn't clear at the moment, and then this is again a future work, what is the optimal strategy? Should you really collect 50 or 100 tilt views and make your 3D reconstruction? Or should you do what Peter and I tried to do, which is to collect 2 and use the second one to check that you've got the first one right? Or was one better, or 3, or 10? You know, that's not really clear yet. So if we could work at it and figure out what are the problems, and how can you use the fact that you know the tilt angles from the goniometer between these different views, you'll be halfway between the other types of cryomicroscopy and this tomography. And that would, so I thought I'd show a tomogram. This is Sam Lee, who has just applied for a number of jobs, all in American universities. So if you are a department chairman looking for it, Sam's the man. That's his section of the tomographic reconstruction. This is, he works on spindle pole bodies, and they pull the DNA apart at cell division, and this is in yeast. Okay, so now I've only got 2 little things left. So that was just sort of some thoughts, really. But so what are, and this may well lead into David's talk, what are the things that we can look forward to that might help us? So one is, we definitely want better microscopes, and I rather like the idea of having chromatic aberration corrected microscope, because then all of those energy loss electrons that are often focused back wrongly, and some people like to throw away with their energy filter, might well help you to get a better image, but probably only out to 10 angstrom resolution. But that's the resolution that you use to do the alignments and the tilt angle determinations and so on. And certainly it's true that at very low resolution, you have very low contrast with bright field phase contrast defocus imaging. And so phase plates that I think others will be talking about would be absolutely great, provided they worked well and didn't take away as much as they gave you. And it would be especially useful in the very thick specimens that are used in tomography to have a CC corrector. And the phase plate would be particularly valuable in the very low resolution parts in the single particle alignment, where you really need that power. I'll talk a bit about detectors tomorrow, but you really want a high detective quantum efficiency, which is equivalent to saying, if I've got 100 electrons going through the specimen and being recorded on the detector, you want to record every one of them equally, and you don't want to miss half of them, and you don't want half of them to give you a signal 20 times smaller than the other half. And I'll show you one picture at the end about that. And then also you want the image of the electrons in the detector to be highly localized so that it doesn't fade out as you go out to high resolution. Many of the problems in current detectors could be overcome if you simply had a very big one and you did adjacent pixel averaging and you threw away the fact that you know they've got, let's say, 8,000 pixels square. If you average it down to 1,000, then the detectors are really quite good. And then also you definitely want low noise so you can be much better than film. And then the third area where I think there are a lot of very simple very simple experiments that are from first principles. You ask, what is the orientation? How do I know that I've got it right? How much does it change as you irradiate it? It ought to be possible to design experiments that measure them, and when you've measured them, you can then start varying the parameters and try and overcome it and figure out, you know, we certainly get ice contamination in all of our microscopes. Of course, we've got film, and there are no other people who claim that you don't get ice contamination. I don't believe it at the moment, but it's most people don't. They want their result, and they don't worry about it. So I think there are a lot of things to do with making better images that we could be working out. All right, this is the only new slide. Those are all rehashed kind of hand-waving things from the past. This we think is quite interesting, and actually most we didn't certainly think about it, and most people don't know it. So what this is one of these new detectors, one of these CMOS detectors, which is basically a silicon, just like in your digital camera. The electrons go directly into the silicon. There's no phosphor, no fiber optics, no film. And it's been corrected for all of the sort of instrumental things. And the dose has been reduced so that, roughly speaking, so this is one region of the detector. And we've actually taken about, this is with Wazi Faruqi and Greg McMullen, and I'll talk about this a bit more tomorrow. But these are 25 frames out of about 10,000 frames, and the dose was adjusted to have, roughly speaking, one electron per frame, and you just let it run. And what we've done is we've picked 25 of the most interesting-looking pictures out of those 5,000. Most of them, a lot of them have nothing on them, because one per frame means none is quite often. But what this is showing you is what each individual electron does when it goes into your film or into your phosphor fiber optic detector or into this new type of solid state detector. And it isn't what you'd expect. So what you see is all of the things you see, the noise level's very low. They're all, so that is a single electron going through the little detector layer and leaving a little bit of charge, which is collected and then converted into a signal. Here is another one, and another one, and another one. But if you look at, we put numbers on by integrating them. This one has 138 units of charge, but this one over here has 4,400 units of charge. And what's happened there, it's one electron in each case, but this one has gone in, and it's been scattered by the atoms that it hits, and it's gone along. So that it's left all the energy. So this is all, it's actually only 120 kV. 120 kV of energy has been deposited as a big blotch. It's not in one pixel, it's in several pixels. So it's a little track that's dumped all the energy. So that's 100 kV. So this one here is only about 3 or 4 kV. That one went straight down, right through into the detector, and left a very sharp, very high-resolution spot with the image. But if you look around, you see lots of other things. So, for example, here is a little spot right next to a big spot. So what's happened there is the electron went through the detector layer, left a little high-resolution spot. That's where it arrived, but it went down, and then it was backscattered, and it came back, and then it dumped its energy next to it, 30, 40, 50 microns away. And that's happening in your film and in your phosphor fiber optics ones. And there are lots of them. Here's one with two that are more equal. Here's one further apart, the sharp one and the heavier one from the backscatter. There's lots of doubles down here. Some of them are unresolved. Here's one where it's quite far apart. It's gone down a long way in and come a long way back. And what that shows is that each electron is not depositing the same amount of signal. There's a factor of 30 or 40 different between them. It's not localized. It comes back and backscattered. And I'll talk a bit more about that tomorrow. So my feeling is when you look at this, you realize how bad everything we're doing, how bad it is, and how much more there is available to be done. So in order to move from being the pessimist to being the optimist, you have to diagnose each of the things that's wrong and then fix them. And then we will be able to have a kind of optimistic future. So sorry it took a little bit longer than I thought, Ron.
Thanks, Richard. That there will be an incredible number of questions and discussion about that tomorrow. I think in the interest of time, we'll just move straight ahead. And this is a bit selfish, actually, because I want to discuss all this in the panel tomorrow, so I don't want to take any questions now. So David is the next speaker, and we'll be ready in a second.
Is this on? Okay.